Good evening, one and all. Welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We've got the whole crew of the Enterprise with us, Captain Kirk. We have Larry and Nader and JB. How are you, fellas?
Good.
Doing good.
Good. When we finished the observation show this afternoon, we talked briefly about an idea that Roy had postulated toward the conclusion of Chapter 10 of Observation. Now, at this point, we're actually at the beginning of Chapter 7, and we may return there before the program's over. But Roy made the suggestion that as we talk about dimensionality, and listen, when we're talking about Yala in the seventh dimension and us in the third dimension, stuck in the ordinary flow of time, we're always doing some speculation here. But I think the speculation is has been really interesting. So as I had asked Roy to review the Chapter 10, I'm currently completing Chapter 11 on observation, just for a frame of reference. And I was talking, we came across a passage, which I'll read you in just a second, which had meod in it, but it wasn't just meod, it's meod squared, meod, meod. And meod means to the greatest extent possible. And so meod, meod would be sort of like infinity squared. And it appeared in this particular passage. So Roy made this suggestion. He says, you know, I think there's a parallel between dimensions and the Mikra, and perhaps even with the statements that Yah etched in stone. And he started it off with some interesting ideas that at least got me going. And 4 days later, I was only 8 or 9 paragraphs. It should have been easier than that, but it took me a while. I've done my best to throw out what I would consider to be A, a collaborative effort, and B, food for thought on the parallels between dimensionality, the potential that there are seven dimensions, their tie-in with the seven Moed Mikra, with the first seven statements that Yahweh etched in stone, and a significant degree, I think, they also parallel the 7 days of creation. So, let me, I'm going to begin here, and you guys jump in any time that you'd like, and if you don't like this, of course, the smart thing to do is to blame Roy. And if you...
I always hated that guy.
If you do like it, Craig gets all the credit.
That is correct. That's what I was trying to set up. Exactly what I was trying to set up here. Okay, this begins. This is in the 17th chapter of Yashaya, excuse me, of Bereshith, of in the beginning, Genesis. So we're in, this is, I think, the second to last meeting between Yahweh and Abraham. And it goes like this. It says, I will enable you to flourish and to be fruitful. That's a good start. I will enable you to be productive. You know, we've talked about that. God likes productive people. He chose to work through people, and the people he chooses to work through usually are active. They're engaged. They want to make a difference. They're productive. And conceive offspring in abundance through you, creating a plentiful harvest in successive generations, with you serving as a highly productive vine, written in the hip hole perfectly. So I will enable you to flourish and be fruitful. Moed, meod actually, M-E-O-D, to an extraordinary degree and to the highest measured point on any scale, by abundantly increasing capabilities and exceedingly empowering, mightily prolonging time to the greatest extent possible. So this is the concept that we derive from Shavua, where we are empowered and we are enriched. This is what God is saying here. This is, I'm going to empower you, I'm going to enrich you to an extraordinary degree. Then I will allow and produce through you, accordingly, Gentiles, nations and people related by geography, ethnicity, or politics, and kings who, on account of you, shall come into being. So that's the statement. And the first thing we know is that when a word is repeated in Hebrew, as it is here with miod, miod, the intent is to amplify the word's meaning. It's similar to the square of the speed of light and the formula E equals MC squared. But in this case, the meaning of miod is already, this is what's so interesting about it being repeated, because if you look up just the meaning of miod, the first thing you'll find out is it already means to an extraordinary degree, to the highest point measured on any scale. So what is being presented here, and this is what Yahweh said he's going to do on behalf of Abraham, is essentially the incalculable effect of multiplying infinity by infinity. And based upon what Yahweh has revealed regarding the benefits of the covenant, this is exactly what's going to occur. Each step we take to Yahweh, during each of the first four Mikra, Pesach, Matzah, Mukudim, and Shavua, God increases our dimensionality, taking us from three dimensions to four, from four to five, from five to six, and from six to seven. Each iteration results in an infinite increase in power and capability. Now, when Roy was reading that, doing a edit pass, is when he came up with the idea, you know, I think there's a more direct tie-in than just with the first four Mikra. We have a parallel to our dimensionality in terms of an increase. So what follows is really a collaborative effort then, based upon that. Now, I will tell you that Roy did send me an article that he wrote yesterday that has a couple of interesting insights in it. Before we begin the dimensionality comparison, I want to summarize what I think Roy is searching for. There's three primary aspects of his article. The first, he wants to understand, is Yahweh in the seventh dimension? Is he limited to seven dimensions? Second, why are we then in the third dimension? And if Sheol is, as we anticipate, akin to a black hole, how does that relate to the third and fourth dimension, all the way up to the seventh dimension, and even more interesting, how did Yahweh get Yosha out? So let me begin with my thoughts on all of this. I do think that Yahweh is in the seventh dimension. And in the seventh dimension, while he can do, just like we're in the third dimension, we can build marvelous things. In the seventh dimension, we can do lots of stuff in the third dimension, which is where we are. Yahweh can do lots of stuff in the seventh dimension. And, of course, doing something in seven dimensions is far more magnificent than anything we can do in three. Then he's just a little bit more capable than we are. So he's capable of doing a lot in the seventh dimension, but he can't do anything in the eighth dimension. And if he's going to create a life form in an entire universe, he has to do it in one less dimension. And if he does it in one less dimension, it's easy. For example, it's fairly easy for Kirk, for you to take either a pencil or brushes and pigment and create a two-dimensional representation of a three-dimensional object on a canvas or paper. But if you were to try to do that in three dimensions, it's going to take you a lot more effort. Yeah, now it could be a year versus an hour. Mm-hmm. And you would be incapable of creating anything in the fourth dimension.
Correct.
Very similar with Yahweh. Now, I don't think...
But is there an eighth dimension?
I don't think so.
And that's working out for something.
No, but I don't think so. But I don't think there needs to be, because infinity is a number that never ends. I mean, what infinity means is that the size, the capacity, the scope is always growing, never ending. For example, if Yahweh did not create us to have relationships, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for him to grow. If Yahweh does not grow, he cannot be infinite. So to be infinite already from our finite mortal perspective in a material three-dimensional world is extraordinary. Well, let me give you an example. We're stuck on this rock, the third rock from the sun. And the furthest man's ever gotten is to the little rock that's orbiting our rock. We've sent probes out further, but we ourselves have never gotten beyond our planet and its moon. And it's unlikely we ever will. And the universe, nonetheless, is gargantuan. There are probably in the range of 400 billion galaxies like our Milky Way. Our Milky Way has about 400 billion suns in it. And so if you think about the magnitude of all of that, in just three dimensions now, the universe is, from our perspective, essentially infinite. And that's in three dimensions. Now, if we had the capacity to view it from the fourth dimension, it would be infinity times infinity. And as we go from four dimensions to five, we're multiplying infinity times infinity times infinity. And from five to six is multiplied by infinity again. And from six to seven, we have once again multiplying that number, which is incalculable, by infinity again. And then in the seventh dimension, Yahweh is extraordinarily capable, and it is an amazing place, a seven-dimensional construct. And so we could spend all eternity and never get bored if we just never left what he creates on our behalf in the seventh dimension. But he can create as many six-dimensional universes as he wishes for our entertainment. And we can't even fathom what it would be like to be able to fully examine and visit everything within our three-dimensional universe. So if God, in fact, is limited to the seventh dimension, that's a limit beyond our comprehension. And it's a limit that today, well, why would you want anything more?
Then it also explains...
Because enough is never enough.
I think infinity times infinity times infinity... Well, see, infinity is never enough. You can't have...
you can never
find infinity.
Infinity
right.
Never stops.
So just one infinity, which would be this entire universe... Would in fact, in three dimensions, I would give that enough, and we're going to multiply that by infinity times infinity times infinity times infinity. Now, the point that Roy made, which is really interesting, why are we in three dimensions if he's in seven? Why didn't he put us in four dimensions? I mean, we'd have an infinite amount of time if we were in the fourth dimension. But the problem is that if we're in the fourth dimension, we have to be akin to light. Light is really the only thing that can survive in that fourth dimension. It defines the fourth dimension, time. And if we were there, then God...
We couldn't have ever been a carbon construct, for one thing. This life force just couldn't...
Well, he did that, and that's the Malachar, and the Malach came
right.
The story,
that's
which is why too. We have...
Yeah.
That was his point. He says, if we were created in any higher dimension, then we'd be back to the Christian and Muslim, Islamic idea of heaven or hell. You either obey the grand poobah, or he sees to it that you're tortured forever, because if we were four-dimensional, we could not die. We would exist.
We're in the exact perfect location we need to be.
Right.
We're in three dimensions moving through the fourth.
Because in three dimensions, if you choose not Yah, but you don't lead other people astray, there is no eternal consequence. For example, in a black hole, a physical body is destroyed. And when the physical body is destroyed, the operating system of our brain ceases to function.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no continued consciousness. There is no pain. There is no existence. For a physical body to go into a black hole, it's just over.
Mm-hmm.
But if light goes into a black hole, that's not the case. It continues to exist.
Well, you're back. You're also back to, you're right back to the free will and choice.
Right.
You know, for him to grow, you know, I mean, it'd be one thing if he's making a robot. You know, he's trying to grow through robotics, let's say. You know, I mean, he could easily do that. But he's talking about taking units of free will who want to become a part of it, which, of course, we all
right.
do. And so if once you've started in the fourth dimension, you've already eliminated choice. Choices are made here in the third dimension. I mean, I get that. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's the reason that we can't be beyond three is because if we were four, we'd be back to a sadistic God. Love me or you're going to be forever tortured. There couldn't be three doors if we were in the fourth dimension. So that explains why we're in three. But there's another aspect of it. As a seven-dimensional construct, the absolute minimum dimension that we can exist in, and for Yahweh to be able to manifest himself, to expose himself, to reveal himself, is the third dimension.
That's
as a matter
right.
of fact, in,
that's
in
right.
two dimensions,
yeah, he
light cannot exist.
He couldn't. Yeah, he couldn't.
Yeah.
He couldn't. Display himself to a book as an example, or
correct,
right?
Right.
I
Nor
mean,
could he create
no,
life in two dimensions. In two dimensions, life cannot exist, and in three dimensions, life is mortal.
Eternal.
That's that hand reaching down again.
Yeah.
Coming out
so
of it,
I thought all of
that
was really interesting, and then the
that's all true too.
Wrong, Roy will correct me, I'm sure. But this is my summation of it now. The next part of it was, okay, if Sheol is a black hole and Yosha's soul went into Sheol, how did Yahweh get him out? And this is the place where I may differ from Roy. So I apologize here to have his name dragged through the mud if I get this wrong. When Yahweh told us that he is light, that's true to a degree, but it's not completely true. Light is the best representation of who he is, of what he is like, of anything that we can experience.
Yeah.
Well, it would be the same thing as saying life. It would be the same thing as saying life, because everything we see, the chairs we're on, the computer desk in front of us, the phones we're on, are all stabilized light forms. I mean, we know that.
Right.
That has to be something we can relate to. That's the only thing we can relate to.
Yeah. So when Yahweh says I am light, what he's saying is that of all of the things and that you can observe, the thing that is most symbolic of my nature, representative of my nature, is light. And of course it is. Light defines time. It is immortal. It is the first aspect of the creation when Yahweh said, let there be light, haya or. And light is, when you look at E equals MC squared, if you see the difference between the energy, the capability of light versus matter, of energy versus matter. And so it's a marvelous tool. Light enables us to be observant, to see what is around us. Light's a marvelous metaphor for its nature. It even breaks with the rainbow into seven distinct colors. However, yeah, it was a lot more than light. You know, I can turn on the light bulb in my room, and that's not God. I can look at the light of the sun and say, you know, That's marvelous, but that's not God. So he is a lot more than light, but he uses light as a symbol so that we might better understand his nature.
Well, I mean, he's the bread of life, too. I mean, he uses
right.
a lot of
right.
metaphors. He just says
right.
he's most closely associated
right.
with life.
Now, if you look at Sheol, Yahweh did not come up with the metaphor for Sheol of a black hole. I did.
Right.
And the reason I came up with a black hole as a metaphor for Sheol is the same reason he came up with the metaphor of light to represent his nature. As I listened to what he had to say about Sheol, that is a lightless place separated from him, where beings which are comprised essentially of light are eternal. They have everlasting consciousness, but they can't escape. You know, that sounds awful like a black hole.
I think it's described, too, as having great
yeah.
pressure, too.
Yeah, oh,
and,
yeah.
And
a lot of,
yeah.
Exactly.
That would be
yeah.
a black hole.
Crushing
yeah.
pressure. And so the more you study what he had to say about this crushing pressure, about the kind of almost the singular dimensionality of it, the eternal existence of time, eternal consciousness, beings comprised of, that's a prison created for beings comprised of light, it's pretty hard not to draw a parallel to a black hole. Now, that helps us understand what Sheol is like. But to say that Sheol is nothing more than a black hole, when in fact there may be a billion black holes in the universe, I think is an inadequate depiction of Sheol. So I think that the black hole is the closest analog that we have to understand what Sheol is going to be like. But if we take that metaphor too far, that comparison too far, I think we end up diminishing really the full nature of Sheol. Now, the reason I don't think that Sheol is just a black hole is, for example, Yahweh is going to destroy this universe. In year 7,000 Yah, with us as witnesses, he's not going to destroy this one, which would be a grand spectacle, mm-hmm. but he's going to create a new one with in our presence. It'll be the greatest show in the history of time.
Ever.
Yeah,
yeah,
and when he destroys Sheol, that's going to be amazing. I mean, you're going to go, okay, now, watch this. And you want to pull the next lever? Okay, what variable do you want in this equation? When he does that, if Sheol was nothing more than a black hole,
then it would be destroyed. Yeah.
That is correct. That would be destroyed. So yeah. I think that we have to be a little, we can apply all of our thoughts to Sheol and the comparison of a black hole and gain enormous understanding so long as we're open to the realization that just like Yahweh could be best understood as light, that doesn't mean that he is just light and nothing more than light. The same thing would be true with Sheol and the black hole comparison. Okay, now with that. There appears to be more to this than this. A physician, biologist, and mathematician, who is a covenant member down in the Land of Oz, collaborated on the following synthesis of parallels between the seven Moed dimensions. Actually, Roy had a considerable amount to say, I think, on the first two or three. And from there, I'm in the realm of putting my own neck
you
on the line.
You kind of took the ball and ran with it?
Yeah, that's what he said. He said, okay, I've started you in the right direction now. You need to...
I'm abandoning his ship.
Yeah, to develop this. And part of that is because I take some liberties as it relates to the fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions that he thinks are plausible, but may not, as a scientist, want to endorse. And that's why I'm going to tell you that all of this is conjecture. But
it's fun to speculate.
We're given brains, you know, it's thoughtful. It's thoughtful conjecture, and it's stimulating conjecture. So here are some of the parallels between the seven Moed, the seven Mioed dimensions, the seven Moed invitations to meet, the 7 days of Mara creation, and the first seven Gabar statements that Yahweh etched in stone. The first dimension, length, seems to correspond with Pesach Passover, the place where life becomes eternal. 1D, which is a line, albeit not necessarily straight, can be truncated or infinite. It grows out of zero dimension, which is a point, a singularity. A line presented as a singular dimension may be symbolic of the timeline of life. Whatever that may have been in the past and what it will become in the future. Life, like the timeline, emerged from the singularity which precipitated the Big Bang. This explosion of light coalesced into the mix of energy and matter that eventually produced living beings and ultimately provided us with the opportunity to know our Creator. The transformational events occurring on the first day served as the necessary prerequisites, setting the stage for life's conception. Without Pesach, Yahweh's doorway to life, the mortal timeline is short. But with Pesach as a portal into the next dimension, this line, this lifeline, extends forever into the future. Also interesting, the story of Pesach and the length of days is reflected in the first statement Yahweh etched on the first tablet, as it serves as an invitation to live forever with God, to be liberated by Him. It was on this day that the one and only God started everything into motion with a singular verb, Haya, to exist, let there be, and a single noun, the object of that verb, or light, which serves to define time itself. So, the first dimension, which is length, defined by a line, timeline of life, ties directly into Pesach, ties directly into the first statement that Yahweh etched in stone, ties directly into the first day of creation. There's a direct parallel between those four things. Those four things are all speaking of the same thing. That's just the first dimension. The second dimension, depth, seems to correspond to matzah. And the reason I've written all this seems to, I don't want to pretend that either Roy is infallible, and I certainly don't want to pretend that I'm infallible. So I'm just going to leave it as seems.
You're not going to make the claim the Pope makes?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not. And the thing is,
what's
going to
happen to your cult status now? How are you going to be our cult leader if you're not infallible?
Our cult leader is Yahweh. He is infallible. And our likelihood of being correct, because we have adopted his perspective on life and on all things, is a billion, billion, billion times better than the Pope. But with that comes humility that says, no man is inerrant. In fact, language is incapable of being inerrant. The second dimension, depth, seems to correspond to matzah, unyeasted bread, the road to vindication and perfection. At this time, mankind is presented with a binary decision. Remain as one, which leads to zero, or select two, which leads to three. It's one choice among two options. 2D is the day of separation. We can either choose to live with Yahweh, who is perfect, or die with imperfect men. While 1D cannot be seen, and 2D is too thin to support life, matzah represents the most important intersection along the road to life where we can decide to accept the Iowa's terms and conditions. We can ignore them by meandering right through this intersection or crash, trying to change the rules of God's roadway. On unyeasted bread, we are either perfected or not, and not isn't permissible in Yah's presence. We can stay on our life's mortal timeline or climb a dimension above it. As a result, Matzah and the second dimension represent the binary decision between the religion of man or a relationship with God. As such, the subject of the second statement Yahweh wrote on the first tablet, where he encouraged mankind to avoid every aspect of man's most debilitating institution, religion, is a direct tie to this choice. It is also the subject of creation's second day, a time of expansion, of Asher, relativity, which presents the path to the benefits of the relationship. So, once again, we have, I think, a very compelling parallel between the Asher and the expansion, the relativity of the second day of creation, between Yahweh's choice saying, you know, you can observe the terms and conditions of my covenant and receive my mercy, or you can be religious and die. And with the second mikra, matzah, which is the crossroads that so many miss in this mortal life, where God says,
well,
I will remove.
You're certainly becoming perfected. You're becoming perfected there.
Yeah.
That's those are in his words, and that's strong. This is really good, by the way.
Good.
Keep going, man. Aaron.
Okay,
good.
The third dimension, height, seems to correspond to Bukurim, firstborn children. 3D is where physical life becomes possible, and spiritual existence can commence. At this juncture, some continue their ascent to God, while others descend, falling further away from Him. In the third dimension, it is now possible for the benefits of the first two mikrei to be realized, which explains why Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim are always celebrated together, why they were fulfilled by Yosha at the same time, why they should be viewed as three acts in the same play. It is at the completion of one's mortal existence in 3D that each soul is directed through one of three distinct doorways through which human lives pass: eternal life with Yahweh, the death and destruction of one's soul, or eternal separation, each based on the choices we make relative to God's instructions. Not surprisingly, the third and final statement Yah scribed on the first of the two tablets contains a stern warning regarding the consequences of our actions relative to Yahweh in this life. And while life is technically possible in 3D, without an extension of time, it loses its value. Therefore, we should not be surprised that life was conceived on this, the third day of creation.
That's right. That's good. That's good.
That's interesting.
I mean, that's strong.
Yeah. That kind of smacks you in the face of a duh.
It's a brilliant observation.
Here is the unforgivable. Sam, in this life, you belittle my name, and you make it for naught. That's it for you. And so
I've heard you say on a number of occasions, if you want to downplay Yahweh's name, there's a quid pro quo there.
And here, firstborn
your name the same thought.
It's the third mikra, and life was conceived on the third day. Boy, there's really strong tie-ins here, and in 3D, with height added to length and breadth, it's the first time that life is even possible.
Well,
created on the third day. That's when we're born into Yahweh's family. You know, being immortal is not necessarily a good thing. Being perfected is a good thing, but these things only have value. Being immortal and being perfected only have value when we're born spiritually and adopted into Yahweh's family. And so on the third day, the life that God intended for us becomes possible, just like physical life is now possible in three dimensions.
Well, just like on Matzah, I mean, just to regress there a little bit, go back to day two here, or not so much day two, 2D. As Yahusha found the light, okay, there are others in there that didn't and never will. And so, you know, that is a choice, isn't it? That brought about choice. It really did, entering the doorway at Pesach is a choice, too. So maybe there's another aspect to that. But that is certainly, wow, okay. I'm liking this. I really am.
Yeah. Now, so that you know, James, if you have the opportunity, I think Roy has tried to call in, and he's listening to us now. If you can find one of the callers that's on the line, it looks like I'll look again to find his area code, but it's a let me just look here once again. We'll get his area or country code 07, and then the first three numbers are 337. If you can find it, JB, that would be great.
Okay,
now,
I'll take it.
All right, now as we're moving into the fourth dimension. The fourth dimension, time, seems to correspond to Shavua, the promise of the Shabbat in seven. Shavua is the fourth Mikra, and it was fulfilled as the final invitation to be called out and meet with God in the Yobel year of 4000 Yah. That would be 33 CE on the Imperial Roman and Roman Catholic calendar. Stuck in the ordinary flow of time, physical life, while possible beginning in 3D, just like the plants that were conceived on this day, remain rooted in time. In 4D, mass is a spiritual impediment, a navigational liability. Keeping those rooted in the previous dimension, grounded and time-bound. To progress into the fullness of the fourth dimension, we have to be enormously empowered, which is to be on the energy side of E equals MC squared. Mass essentially imprisons us on this rock we call the Earth. Physical bodies comprise a barrier to entry, a limiting factor for those who wish to explore the universe with our Maker and dimensions beyond our comprehension. And so it is on Shavua that Yahweh's children are empowered and enriched, in effect, liberated in the fourth dimension, thereby facilitating the benefits of the covenant, making the lives of God's children infinitely valuable, infinitely capable, and enduring. Equally notable, since Shavua is observed seven sevens from Bukurim, its promise is reflected in the fourth statement, Yahweh etched in stone, the first instruction on the second of his two tablets, which was entirely focused on the benefits and purpose of the Shabbat. Moreover, the fourth day of creation was focused upon light and time, with the sun and moon becoming visible so that God's children might properly assess the timing of the Moed, the appointed meetings, which are known as the Mikra.
Wow.
Is that Craig?
Yes. Is this Roy?
Hello.
Yeah, yes. Hi, Roy.
Hey, Roy, how are you, Craig?
Doing great. We've got Larry here and Kirk, and JB is the one who found you on the line there.
Yes, good. Can I make an observation? I have been listening to what you've been saying.
Okay.
I'm made of compressed light. We all are. The computer I'm looking at is made of compressed light. But I'm not the same as the computer. I can see no reason why Yah could not be made of another version of light, if you like, that is still light. In other words, he can still be made of light, but it might be a different form of compression of light.
That's entirely possible. So what you're saying here is that, well, my comment was that that I look at the sun and that's a source of light. Yah was not the sun. I look at the light bulb. It's a source of light. He is not he is not the light bulb. What you're saying is that really everything in the universe is comprised of light. Time itself is defined by light, and that and that light comes in many forms. And you know, we know the gradient of those various forms of energy, and that it comes in many forms, and that Yahweh could in fact be light. He is just the sum total of all of the forms of light that we know, plus many that we do not yet comprehend.
Yeah. Well, he's probably actually... the visible spectrum is very small in comparison to all the electromagnetic radiation. And that's what we're mostly aware of. We're aware of heat. We can feel heat, for example.
Right.
We can't see beyond the ultra... We'd be beyond violet, into ultraviolet and gamma rays, that sort of thing. He is probably encompasses the whole spectrum of the electromagnetic radiation.
Yeah.
But the thing is that light is just energy, and it's my hypothesis was that it passes through all the dimensions. And I think that's reasonable. If you look downwards from 3-2 to 1, obviously the energy that we have must be encompassed by or be in the second and the first dimensions. So if you take it the other way, then the same energy must be, if you like, flowing through all the dimensions up to infinity.
Yeah, it's one of the few things that we know that that we can observe light in 2 and 1D. And since we know that light exists in 2 and 1D, and that we know that light defines 4D, it is the thing that it's the full spectrum of electromagnetic radiation in our... in our experience, that it only makes sense that that light would be able to exist and travel in all 7 dimensions.
Yes.
And one of the things that we've talked about on this program before, and I'll let you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you hinted at it here, is that and matter is really comprised of light. Matter is one form of organized energy. That's why E equals MC squared, the equation works, that everything really that is around us is comprised of some form of light energy, and it's just organized into different forms.
Yes, that's right.
You were up to the third or fourth dimension. A significant amount of what I covered, although I extrapolated beyond what you said, and then I also tied this into the days of creation. But as we went over the time, the length, the dimension of length, the first dimension, and the timeline of life, did you have any constructive criticism on the first day?
No, none whatsoever. You pretty well encompassed everything that I've said, I think. I'd agree with that. In fact, I think that's a brilliant rewriting of what I've written.
Yeah, all I really did the first day is I added the realization that it's really tied, that it's not just the, it is the dimension, and I tried to define the dimension as length, because it suits our... the mental picture, I think, that of the timeline, but the timeline is yours. The this concept of it just tying out of the Big Bang. It's the singularity that grew into with this explosion of light energy. But it certainly seems to parallel the creative account. I mean, I think there's a in many ways an even more direct parallel to the 7 days of creation with the seven dimensions than there is with the seven statements judged in stone, although I see an absolute perfect fit with the seven Mikra.
Well, then you also have the 7,000 years, you know, going in there, too. I mean, talk about master strokes. I mean, that's why there's so much of the Torah we can't see. And by the way, don't feel bad about this, Roy. Don't feel bad about this at all, because Craig's a lot brighter than you are.
Well, I know that.
it's funny when I was
most people are.
When Kirk and I were talking about this in the observation show, this is funny. When Kirk and I were talking about doing this, and we didn't know if we'd be able to get you on the program, and I said, you know, Roy and I have when we exchanged a fair number of emails, and I think we have developed a comfort level that if I made errors in representing what you were conveying, it isn't going to harm our relationship. You're not going to be bothered by it. You might send me an email and say, you know, I think that you extrapolated beyond what's reasonable here, and I would you may want to think of it this way. But I can misrepresent something you've said, and it's not going to hurt our relationship. That's why I think I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to take the chance of going ahead and doing this.
No, it just look. I don't get all bent out of shape if someone makes a mistake in representing me. The only time that I do get bent out of shape is if someone willfully and deliberately lies about what I've been saying. And I'm sure that you've never done that. So none of this sort of thing worries me. I'm not infallible. Quite right. Nobody's infallible.
Roy, you should thank God you're not over here involved in politics running against Hillary Clinton, then. That's all I can tell you.
Larry, I keep a very close eye on what's going on over there, and I don't know how much longer your country's got to exist, but I can't imagine.
Not long. This is just, you know, they could have went out and got a garbage man for real that was illiterate.
Oh, I would have
put him there.
I know,
his intent would certainly be better.
I actually rather like
him.
As I say, he's a good guy.
That's my case.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so and when we moved into the second dimension, just by way of a recap, we get our bearings. It struck me, and
before you go on,
extrapolation. Before you go on,
observation.
Yeah.
Black holes. I don't know whether you're familiar with. A fellow called Stephen Hawking.
Oh, yeah.
Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, kind of a jerk, but we know him.
He formulated an idea, and there's strong evidence that it's probably true, that black holes, in fact, evaporate. Now, it takes a long time for them to do so, very long time to do so, but they do evaporate. They disappear into nothing. Our universe will eventually suffer a thermal death. That is to say that from what we know of what's going on, it's not just expanding, but its expansion is accelerating.
Correct.
That means that eventually, according to the laws of thermodynamics, everything will eventually sort of come down to what's called thermal equilibrium. That means to say that it's a thermodynamic death, or that nothing can happen. So the universe essentially sort of evaporates away into nothingness.
Right.
Expanding. It would become too thin to exist in its normal
state. Two interesting things on that, too, Roy. Of course, one of them is that, the universe is not going to give, this universe is not going to be given the time to wind down into nothingness.
That's what I was saying.
The more interesting thing that is about that is that I just lost my train of thought here for I'm sorry. But anyway, as we know, this existing universe, it's going to end in year 7,000, so it's never going to see a natural death. But
Roy, can I ask you something? Do you mind, Craig, real quick?
Sure. Okay.
What do you think of Stephen Hawking's idea once we realized DNA was actually a double helix language? That proved there's no God. I mean, that's pure insanity. You know,
yeah,
this
like
right.
Of
the language
full of prophecy
fell out of nowhere.
No author.
Yeah.
That's obvious stupidity because we're dealing with a code. And the DNA
well, that's why I said what I said about
carrying
it.
The code.
Yeah, exactly. It's so bizarre.
Writing on a page. I mean, the page is not the thing that carries the information. It's not even the ink necessarily that it's the way that the ink is formed on the page that carries the information. And it's the same sort of thing with the DNA double helix. Yeah,
one of the things I was going to say, Roy, was
that's
that,
a way to put it. That very good
you
one.
Talk about the universe as the expansion is accelerating. In fact, it appears that the universe is expanding faster than the speed of light, which means that space itself is expanding, which creates the impression that things are moving away from us faster than the speed of light, because space itself is expanding, and of course, what is it expanding into? Not a good explanation for that, of course, in science at this point. Now,
we don't know, but what I was getting at, what you're hinting at there was that if you're in a black hole, the black hole will expand along with everything else. It will be left behind in a universe that is suffering a thermal death. Would it be simply that we've been pulled out from the three dimensions in which we now find ourselves, if you like, back through the Big Bang hole? I know this is all speculative stuff, to get into the fourth dimension, because, I mean, it must be that the Big Bang itself is the point through which you poke the universe from at least the fourth dimension to produce our universe.
Yes.
So if we're going to be taken back or taken up to a higher state or a higher dimension, would it be that we go back through that hole? I mean, that's yet speculation on my part. I can fully admit that.
Yeah.
There's probably many other explanations for it. But what we then find is that the universe that we're in now is just simply left behind to die of its own accord.
Yes. Now, I think that is one possibility, is that we're pulled back out of the singularity that the universe was conceived through. The other is that the universe that we are in could well be six dimensions. And I realize it becomes very dicey in terms of what is a dimension, and we're going to go on to some things that are my own personal speculation, because the dimension has always been something that intersects the other dimensions at a right angle. Now, we understand how length, depth, and height intersect each in a right angle, but we have no idea how time intersects those, and we accept time as a dimension. We can model it mathematically, but we cannot envision it. Just as if you were a two-dimensional construct, you could not fathom how a third dimension would intersect flatland. In three dimensions, we can't understand how time intersects at a 90-degree angle to the existing three, other than mathematically modeling it. And so I'm going to speculate on five and six and seven as dimensions, as opposed to just unknown forms of either mass or energy.
Dimensions are just simply, as you say, a mathematical construct. We understand dimensions because we've made a model in which lines intersect at right angles. Now, we don't know what a right angle in the fourth dimension is. We can, as you say, model it mathematically. But the point is that this universe does not, and probably never will, in fact, it never could, actually fill all of the theoretical, if you like, theoretically infinite third dimension.
Correct.
So, in other words, it's expanding. It's expanding out and out and out. And as Larry says, it dilutes down to nothing. Eventually, it just disappears. But it hasn't taken us up to the fourth dimension. The question would be, in other words, if the third dimension, if you like, is poked through a hole, in the same way that we would sort of poke a hole in a bit of paper as the second dimension, or into a hole in the second dimension, the universe. Now I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah,
we were talking about the expansion of the universe.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now, Roy, I'll just change the subject here to get kind of back to where we were. The first two dimensions, particularly with the Iowa's emphasis on the expansion of the universe and of Asher relativity, which presents the path to the benefits of the relationship, and this intersection along that that line to create the second dimension. It's the parallels across the board to creation's second day, to Yahweh's second statement, where this is your choice. It's religion or relationship. You can observe the terms of the relationship, or you can be religious, but you can't have both. Those parallels become undeniable. The third day is even more direct in terms of the parallels, where you wrote that life is technically possible on the in the 3D, but you know life in 3D is still grounded in time, and we are stuck in the ordinary flow of time. And while Yahweh created life on the third day, the life that He created is rooted life. You know, it's life without a nefesh that cannot observe and respond to its environment. It's plant life that He created on this day. And, of course, Bukhuram is new life. It's spiritual life. So the third day and each of our four things that we're looking at, dimensionality, where life is now possible, Bukhuram, which is the third mikre about being spiritually reborn into Yahweh's family. Yahweh was saying that on the third day that our actions will determine whether or not we even have the opportunity to be forgiven and be in His midst based upon our choices. These things are closely related. And in the fourth dimension, I think they're even more closely related with the fact that now we can be liberated in time. Now we have Shavuah, which the only way to be liberated in time is to become energy-based, and we have Shavuah offering to enrich and empower us.
Interestingly, the first three mikre correspond to the first tablet.
Yes, they do.
The stone.
Perfectly. And the fourth mikre also corresponds to the fourth item that Yahweh etched in stone, because it is Shavuah, the promise of seven. Of what is the fourth statement that Yahweh etched in stone? Instruction on the Shabbat.
Yes, what we're doing
now. There's a absolute perfect parallel between Shavuah, the fourth mikre, and the fourth instruction Yahweh etched in stone on the Shabbat, as there is on the fact that to be liberated in time, to enter the fourth dimension, we have to shed our human alliance. We have to shed our physical bodies, because our physical bodies are an absolute liability in the fourth dimension. And so it's Shavuah is where we're enriched and empowered.
And, you know, it's absolutely an amazing thing. I just want to throw this in. And all your religious notions, at least in the, and again, I'm going to use the non sequitur of the Abrahamic religions, enrichment and empowerment and all these things are taking place in the physical realm. And that's just, it's just untrue. I mean, it's just untrue.
Now, William posed a question here. I'm going to give my answer to it. Then Roy, please jump in. Then we're going to talk a little bit about dimensions before we go to the fifth dimension. The question was, he says, you know, scientists talk about 11 dimensions. How would you correspond, describe that verse as 7? The 11 dimensions were part of string theory. String theory is a model that had some favoritism there for a while, and had some scientists try to promote it. I think string theory is very close to being dead today as a viable alternative, it's improvable. And what they ended up doing essentially is they created 7 outward dimensions, and then 4 dimensions within a point. So within the singularity, there were four dimensions within the singularity to create the model that helped to solve some of the unsolvable aspects of the universe as we know it. But that string theory has gone out of favor recently. That's my layman's assessment of it. What would you say, Roy?
Well, that's pretty well right. My understanding was that there was six dimensions that you could define, and then there was another five that could be mathematically shown, in fact, to actually collapse down to one. You're right about the way that they're a little curled up dimensions, sort of a bit like looking at a wire from a distance. It just looks like a single line. And you get closer, and you can actually have then dimensions sort of going around that wire, was the analogy that they used.
Yes. And by the way, I happen to like the idea of six, and I've seen both six and seven, but I agree with you that six was more popular than seven. And my view is that the universe is six-dimensional. And now I don't ascribe to dimensions within a point, but which you could mathematically model. A six-dimensional outward universe is exactly what I think exists.
But it's curious that they've come up with a theory with six dimensions and essentially a seventh, because the remaining five, have actually collapsed. It depends upon which way you look at it.
Right.
It's always the same thing. It collapses into one, which means you've got seven.
Which is
fascinating.
Yeah, string theory. And what's interesting about string theory, while they there is no way to prove it, the mathematical models work. And so if you analyze our universe, which is essentially at seven dimensions, the six outward and the five collapsed into one, the math works to depict the universe as we observe it.
Yes.
That's the answer, the more scientific and the layman's answer to your question. Now, I want to talk a little bit about dimensions here. Go ahead.
The vast majority of the scientists that I've seen interviewed about string theory have no idea what it's about. I think there's about one or two people. There's some guy who's apparently come up with a thing called M theory, which is another version of it. He's supposed to be the most genius mathematician that's ever existed. There's a whole lot of scientists out there that have no idea what it's all about, even though they're theoretical physicists. They're not fools. I think you're right that string theory, in fact, is probably going to die a natural death simply because it's too complicated. One of the things that I've noticed in studying physics and mathematics is that the beauty of simplicity.
Mm-hmm.
E equals mc squared is a very simple equation, and yet it contains so much information. And if you read the quantum physicists, for example, how some of them came to beautiful equations, it was so simple. And I'm sure that we're going to find that string theory isn't in one of those categories, and that Yar's mathematical constructions are themselves all simple. We simply haven't come across the final solution yet.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I like about string theory is, again, the math models what the six-dimensional universe plus Yahweh I intuitively see in my head. But beyond that, of course, I would agree that the math is way too complicated to really ever wrap your brain around it.
Mm.
Now, since we're discussing dimensions, there is a perceived conflict from this point forward. Scientists tell us that dimensions intersect one another at right angles, as is the case with length, depth, and height, but not with time, at least from our limited perspective on it. But this limitation should not surprise us, because we have the capacity to understand that a two-dimensional construct could possibly envision a third dimension intersecting flat land, providing height. Similarly, as three-dimensional beings stuck in time, we cannot fathom how greater dimensions intersect our own, much less what we would experience within them. So as we move through the fourth through fifth, sixth, and seventh dimensions, the best we can do is extrapolate from what we know to interpret what we seek to understand.
Can I throw something in here? This sure. just hit me. Yes. You know, that dimensions are coming in at right angles, right?
Mathematically.
Mathematically, yeah, sure. That would mean that, as we're climbing these dimensions, we're actually getting to Yahweh. We know that. And that would mean that Yahweh is to our left. We're on his right. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a thought.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And, of course, it's all right angles, which are, from our perspective, upright. Right being square. There's so much in Hebrew is the language itself deals with square, being right, being upright, all the being right, all those things tie in together. All right, the fifth dimension.
That's kind of wild.
Now, I know that what I'm going to say here, Roy, is not substantiated by science. It is it's a point of reference that I've had for a long time, and I'm going to share it as my own personal interpretation. The fifth dimension, I'm going to call it repulsion. I see it as the effect of dark energy. Dark energy, unlike dark matter, is repulsive in nature. It seems to correspond to teruah, trumpets. It is here that the beneficiaries of Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkurim, who are now immortal, perfected and adopted, then empowered, enlightened and enriched during Shavuah, are afforded the opportunity on trumpets to announce a warning to those who have been deluded. The message trumpeted on this day includes an invitation, calling out to those who are actively searching and willing to listen into the realm of the covenant. The players in 5D have all risen from a singularity through the first four dimensions and are now flourishing in the fifth with length of days, breadth of character, walking tall throughout time, fully cognizant of the consequence of being right or being wrong. And it is their souls which are especially germane on trumpets, because their nephesh soul and breath of life impassions the warning that is blown through the shofar ram's horn trumpet and controls the way our breath passes through our larynx to present the most important aspects of Yahweh's message. Also relevant, the first mention of nephesh soul occurs on the fifth day of creation, as Yahweh reveals that all animals he conceived on this day would have a soul, even man, albeit not yet with a neshama, consciousness. Consciousness, however, would enable animals to be observant and responsive, qualities that would set them apart from plants. And since our nephesh soul and breath of life comes from our mortal parents, and the gift of the Spirit is provided through our Heavenly Father and Spiritual Mother, recognizing their significance is the subject of the fifth instruction, Yahweh etched in stone. So here I would say the only real speculation is to whether or not I have defined the fifth dimension accurately. But the rest of this, the fifth day of creation with animal life and nephesh, with teruah, which is all about the nephesh and the soul. The rest of this with our mother and father and viewing them as significantly, it fits together like a glove. Hand in a glove. What are your thoughts, Roy?
Well, I'd agree with that. The dark energy, though, is only a speculative thing at the present time in science anyway. I mean, no one's actually seen it or been able to quantify it. So, in fact, that's just a mathematical model to try to explain why the universe is accelerating.
Yes.
And so,
yeah, otherwise it would be contracting without. But when we call it dark energy, all we know is that energy has a repulsive nature, and so unlike mass, which has a attractive nature, and so we know that there is a repulsive aspect of the universe that's causing it not only to expand, but that expansion to accelerate. And so that's just a name that has been applied to something that we know mathematically has to exist. We just don't know what it is. And I'm not sure we'll ever figure out what it is. I don't think there's enough time left for mankind to figure out what it is.
Well, I don't think we probably ever would anyway, even if we did have plenty of time, because there's certain limitations on what you can observe. But there's a consequence from what you're saying there is that if something's repulsive, it's repulsive against gravity, because gravity is what's going to is trying to pull the universe back. Whether the universe is closed or not depends upon how much matter is there, and we don't know how much matter is there. And it appears that it's open, that is to say that it's expanding and will expand to forever. Normally you'd expect that expansion to remain either constant or to slow down slightly. But if it's accelerating, that suggests that there's some, you know, one of these magical anti-gravity machines at work.
Right.
If that's the case, and there's some means by which gravity's effect can be nullified, then you can enter black holes and remove things or people who have fallen into it.
Correct.
With safety. So the Malak could go down and take you or I out, for example, or
so long as we were spiritual in nature, they could take us out. If we were still mortal in nature, there'd be nothing to take out.
In other words, if we've stuffed up in the universe and fallen into a black hole, could be a means by which we may be able to do that ourselves anyway. Yahusha, of course, his soul didn't have the spirit. So he would not be able to escape by himself. Because the spirit could have gone in there with this anti-gravity device attached, taken his soul and removed him from the black hole.
Well, maybe the spirit just entered him again, and then he took himself out.
Either way
is possible. But here we are in the fifth dimension. It is ultimately the time where we are the only place where we're given directions to shout out a warning, and that Teruah warning is double-sided, that man's way ends in a very bad place, a very bad way. It's calamitous. And that Yah's way leads to life. And we trumpet that message through the shofar, the ram's horn, and the tie-ins with the fifth statement that Yahweh etched in stone, the fifth day of creation, with the first mention of soul, pretty extraordinary. With five, I think we are at this point we're finding tremendous affirmation. Now, here's the sixth dimension. I'm going to call the sixth dimension attraction. I think it's the effect of dark matter. Can't prove that, and we don't even know what dark matter is. But there's something in our universe, and Roy, I think this is correct, that the energy and matter that we are aware of in our universe represents 6% of the total, and that 94% of the energy and matter in the universe has to be comprised of either this thing we call dark matter or this thing we call dark energy. And they comprise 94% of the universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's from Peebles, isn't it?
Yeah. No, that's the way the math works. So it's not like these things are insignificant when we're talking about whatever the attractive force is. Let's just call it attraction rather than dark matter. And repulsion as opposed to dark energy. But the repulsive effect and the attractive effect are significant. And we ought not look at, I don't think, at repulsion as a bad thing. I mean, the whole concept that Yahweh has of set apart is about...
it's about repulsion. It really
about
is.
Repulsion, yeah. Repulsion being separated from one's country, from one's earthly family in the sense of the family of man, and being separated unto God. So everything that's important to God is set apart, and so separation is a big deal. So and without the ability to separate, to be repulsed, you don't have choice. Free will is essentially requires this ability to say, no, I don't want to be part of this, I want to be separated from. And you really, you know, to be part of Yahweh's family, to be one with him, you have to separate yourself from human institutions. So separation is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. You know, so I don't mean that as in a pejorative way. And attraction is can be a good thing if you're attracted to Yahweh and his Torah, but attraction if you're attracted to religion and human institutions is a bad thing. All right, so the sixth dimension, I'm going to call it attraction, seems to correspond to Kippurim reconciliations, which serves as the final referendum between man and God. While they are currently separated from one another and from him, Yahweh's affinity for Yahudah and Yisrael is unwavering. He has promised to reconcile his relationship with his chosen people prior to his return on Yom Kippurim on the Yovel year of 6000 Yah. That's Monday evening at sunset, 6:22 p.m. in Jerusalem, October 2nd, 2033 on the calendar of Imperial Rome and Roman Catholicism. And so we shall. He brought them back home in 1948, liberating Jerusalem on their behalf in 1967, so that he might attract this generation's attention prior to the eradication of every religious institution, as well as all of the men and women who serve as their hosts. With the fulfillment of the sixth mikra, on the day of reconciliation, everyone who has made it thus far is on the cusp of living with Yahweh. They're as far as one can go in this 6D universe. Heaven, in the seventh dimension, is the final step. And so we find that the final addendum to creation was completed on the sixth day with the conception of man in the image of God, of Nesama, conscious man, being brought to life. And since mankind is Yahweh's greatest love, his passion, the sixth instruction God inscribed on his tablets of stone, as was to ask us not to make a habit of killing what he conceived. Those who have followed his guidance thus far have reached the sixth step in his foundational formula. Man, who is conceived on the sixth day in association with God, who is one, enables the creation to live with the Creator. Those are my thoughts on the sixth dimension.
Well, that's all perfectly logical. That's what I like about all of this. It's so logical. It's so rational.
It is.
And not only that, you find consistencies right throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, that's the thing that I like the most, is that I think that Yahweh's, Roy, we may agree on this. I think Yahweh conceived a formula for exactly how and when and how much light to put into the six-dimensional universe, that it was designed for things to work out as they did, and that while there is a lot of chaos built into it so that there could be choice, that Yahweh front-loaded the equation so that it would play out on his timeline. And that this timeline is really essential. So this timeline is not just the 7,000 years that we know of. It's the seven, it's embodied in the 7 days of creation. It's embodied in the seven mikrae. It's embodied in seven dimensions. It is embodied in the first statements, the seven statements that he etched in stone. I see it as an absolute consistent, rational, reinforcing testimony by Yahweh.
Well, it's astoundingly reinforcing. Can I bring something up here,
sure,
though, for some people, just to help bring them up to speed here? You know, we look at the universe and we actually look at the time clock, we can calibrate it against the Earth. What we find, of course, is if we were going to do it exactly, 14.7 billion years equals 6 days. Yeah, it was
correct
from the point of creation.
Correct.
But time also, time also rolls out in epochs of time. Just like there's a beginning of a day and an end of a day, there's an epoch of time there that you got to kind of divide out, and it works like an atomic half-life, sort of, like where if you have 15 billion years, the first day eats up 7.5 billion, and then the next
right.
up 3.25, and the next 1.65, and then you just keep going
right.
down. And so what we find in each of those epochs of time within the fossil record is exactly what Yahweh made said he made on each day. And so
right.
you see, you've got to take that into account too, when you're talking about Nephesh versus Nisthoma and on and on.
Right.
And,
right. I agree with all of that, and it is that's one of the most jaw-dropping of all explanations. What I want to do is I want to get to the seventh dimension. And then, Roy, I want you to help us all understand the temperature of quark confinement that equates to a 14.7 billion-year-old universe from our perspective looking back versus the 13.7 that is now being touted up from 13.4 a few years ago. So let's go over the seven, and then I'd like your input on the temperature of quark confinement that defines whether it's 13.7 or 14.7. Welcome to the seventh dimension, to the realm of clear and complete communication. Now, I see some means to creation as a form of communication, that communication is the basis of understanding, it's the basis of relationship, and it serves to direct light and organize energy into matter, which seems to correspond with Sukkah, camping out with God. During the fulfillment of the Mikra of Sukkah in your 6,000 Yah, just 5 days after his return, the covenant's children will be invited to camp out with Yah in the promised land for 1,000 years, culminating in the year 7,000 Yah, when God will create a new spiritual and material realm, this time with his family as witnesses, enjoying what will be the ultimate spectacle. At the commencement of this time, and throughout eternity thereafter, Yahweh has promised to write a perfect copy of his Torah guidance inside of his children, providing his sons and daughters with instructions needed to explore the universe safely and enjoyably. Those who enter the seventh dimension are home, dwelling beyond the universe in the spiritual realm of God in 7D. As a result, Sukkah Shelters presents mankind residing with in Yahweh's tabernacle, sheltered beneath his tent, if you will. So it is on the seventh day that Yahweh will rest and reflect on what he has set into motion, anticipating that it would all lead to this place, at least for those willing to follow through on his words through space and time. As one happy family of like-minded souls with common interests living in a realm like Eden, wholly devoid of confusion, conflict, or religion, there is now perfect harmony between men and their maker, making the seventh statement Yahweh had long ago etched in stone about not continually being adulterous a fitting memorial of a place, people, and time that no longer exists. This is the conclusion of the journey of a lifetime. It is where the seventh-step path of Yahweh that he spoke about and then personally facilitated eventually leads. Every step we ascend along this way is infinitely enabling, empowering, enriching, and enlightening on behalf of God's children. What began 7 days or nearly 15 billion years ago, depending on one's frame of reference, as a singularity at infinity to the zero power, with the declaration of Haya Or, let there be light, is now I-7. With an infinite and eternal existence set out before all of those who have come to know, understand, and accept the covenant's conditions. Any comments or criticisms or suggestions relative to the seventh dimension?
Darn sure want to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that about sums it up.
Well, no, I think when you're correlating that to the Moed Mikra, it's affirmations.
Yeah.
And when I sit down and it's the same kind of thing you can do with a debate about a word in Paleo Hebrew. You know, we can go over there to Kirk and get that pictorial.
Mm-hmm.
And it verifies what we thought to begin, what direction we should be going in. That's I guess a better way to put it, right?
Yeah.
Kirk.
Yeah.
It's like looking.
God was family, being guided by His hand.
Here's a very simple example, and this is I'm just drawing a parallel here. If I write Yahweh or Yah, that's a Yod, Hena, or Hey, correct?
That's right.
Now, I've heard people, I got into a debate with somebody who tried to tell me, oh, no, it's not Halal, it's Hallel, And I said, no, I don't believe you're right at all, because I think it's the exact opposite of Yahweh, the shepherd leading away, as you say, because Halal ben Shikar becomes... Hena or Hey Yud, right? And
yeah.
So it's exactly backwards. There's an A in there. There's not an E in there. I mean, that's settled it for me. It's the exact,
yeah.
I understand what's happening there.
Yeah.
And so that's what makes sense.
Light
now, how somebody come up with Hallel, I don't know. But see, this is the same thing with the seven Moed Mikra, where you end up, we can't know exactly. You start getting into fifth and sixth and seventh dimensions and stuff like that. I mean, you're not trying to describe them, but you're certainly describing
aspects.
Aspects of it that would
you're giving
fit
them,
in
you're
perfectly.
Giving them symbols. Just like the black hole is a symbol for Sheol, like light is a symbol for Yahweh. You're providing symbols that help us our minds picture what they represent.
Yeah.
For those of us who are puny in mind,
which we all are. Like, Lord thinks mathematically, and we think symbolically, or we think in words, or whatever. So we got to have something to hang a hat on. And it's always, and I agree with Roy, most of the times when the most complex things have become very simple when you look at them, after you study them long enough and say, oh, gosh, why didn't I see that before?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact,
you realize, that, Roy, that almost universally makes you right. If Kirk agrees with you.
Yeah, you need to fix up that improbable business.
Simplicity, this is the thing, and I think, Roy, you hinted at this. The thing that that resonates more with me than anything else is the confidence that comes from the simple understanding of Yahweh as Father, the covenant as family, and us as children. That very simple understanding of who God is and what He wants and how He relates to us and what He is going to do on our behalf, that is an extraordinarily simple concept. And while there are many complicated extrapolations from there, for me, it all boils down to that very simple concept of Bereth being a family-oriented relationship. So I see this whole story as simply as family.
Mm-hmm. Well, the people who have made the decision to be family, that's for sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but that's a choice, and then that brings us right back to, where we're at in this third dimension. You have to be a three-dimensional construct to make a choice. Isn't that where we started at, or thereabouts?
Yeah. Now, Roy, you've done some research on quark confinement, and as I understand it, the 2.73 Kelvin temperature of the residue of the Big Bang as measured from the background radiation, that the extrapolating from there to the point of the singularity expanding through the Big Bang is based primarily at what temperature quarks can be confined, because time doesn't begin until some energy is transformed into matter. And so the temperature of quark confinement actually starts time.
Well, quarks and gluons are actually fundamental particles, I think,
mm-hmm.
And form part of the strong nuclear force. The interesting
right.
thing is that when they're close together, there isn't much force between them, but when they're far apart, the force increases with the distance, which is usually counterintuitive.
Yeah, correct.
But the thing is that means that for them to be free, to be floating around free, you need an enormous temperature. And currently that's around about 2 trillion degrees centigrade. 2 trillion degrees centigrade.
2 trillion, right.
In other words, if you have a temperature that's higher than 2 trillion degrees, then the quarks can be... They won't, in fact, form the baryons and other things that the leptons and so forth that form atoms and eventually us. So for that to happen,
can you imagine a world without leptons? Sorry, poor humor there.
You know, I've often thought of that. I had a dream about that.
I have not.
They've
got the leprosy. They've got these little sticky hands that glue onto everything.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Anyway, once you get below about the U.S. national debt in terms of temperature, then the
about 20 trillion.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
Then I'm out by a factor of 9, aren't I? Yes.
You're in bad shape, man. You got to go back to school.
Yeah, 2 trillion was a long time ago.
Yeah, well,
that's when George Bush took office. It was about 2 trillion.
Okay. Well, he must have started the process, the expansion of the universe. After the Big Bang, this is a lot of this is, of course, theoretical and not proven. There is some evidence for it, apparently, from Hubble's observance, that's the telescope of the universe, and that it's lumpy and there's bits here and bits there, and it doesn't sort of quite fit the original theory. But after about 300,000 years, the temperature had fallen far enough to start the clock, if you like, because at that stage matter was forming from the quarks. And
where does that take us to? Where does that take us to? From 2 trillion to what? 1 trillion or over 3,000?
No, that's below 2 trillion, in other words.
Below
2
trillion.
Below 2 trillion, quarks cannot be liberated. Quarks are confined. Correct?
So that's the temperature.
Right.
So that's 2 by 10 to the 12.
Uh-huh. Which is the stretching of time from a witness to or at the Big Bang versus the flow of time here on Earth is the 10 to the 12th factor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are several estimates on quark confinement, aren't there, on temperatures?
That's where you get that figure from, because 2 by 10 to the 12 divided by roughly 2, well, it's not quite 2, but roughly 2, gives you the 10 to the 12.
Yes.
If you like, it becomes 1 by 10 to the 12, which is 10 to the 12. That,
right.
That's where Schroeder would have got it from.
Yes.
And that's where you get your trillion.
Yes.
Yes.
It's slightly less than that, because in actual fact, it's 2.73 degrees absolute. Or Kelvin,
right.
That's tall. So it's going to be slightly less. So yes, once that starts, then the universe continues to expand, and until we get to today. So the thing is that when all the quarks and gluons join together, you get matter and antimatter. Matter and antimatter eliminated one another. Except that for some reason we don't know, there's a little bit more matter left over than there was antimatter. So as far as we know, all the antimatter in the universe is gone, and all that's left is the matter that we know. Antimatter, incidentally, is not sort of some nebulous concept. It does actually exist. When you do a PET scan, for example, the way that that works is that a positive electron, or positron, annihilates itself by hitting another electron, which is, of course, negatively charged. So the two, when combined, give off, you can't destroy the energy, so the energy has to go somewhere, and it goes in the form of two gamma rays at 180 degrees to one another. And then the gamma camera is used to pick up that coincident radiation, and that you can say with certainty that that came from within inside the patient's body and not from a gamma ray coming from outer space, for example. That's just how a PET scan works. But the once the matter had formed, then it started to coalesce, of course, into stars and things, and you get first-generation stars and second-generation stars. And the thing about a star is that have a nuclear reaction that's like a hydrogen bomb. Hydrogen can fuse into helium and helium into whatever the next one is. I've forgotten what it is now, beryllium or boron or something like that. Anyway, it keeps on going up until and giving out energy. These are what are called exothermic reactions. Exo out of just gives out energy until you get up to iron. And then when you get to iron, the reaction stops because it becomes an endothermic reaction after that. In other words, energy has to be put in, and the star can't do that. Now, if it's a small star, it will then, of course, virtually it'll just switch off. So the energy will dissipate into space. It'll cool and cool and cool and end up as a white dwarf. If it's a bit bigger than that, I think if it's around about four times solar masses, then it can form what's called a neutron star because the gravitational collapse, because I'll just backtrack a minute there. The reason the sun doesn't collapse in on itself now is because of the pressure of the electromagnetic radiation, which we call heat or light or whatever, gamma rays, is pushing the outer parts of the star outwards. When that stops, then gravity takes hold and it pulls everything back into the center. Now, if it's a smallish star, it'll just simply turn out into sort of a burnt-out cinder. If it's a bigger star, it may turn into a neutron star. That means that all the electrons and protons and everything are all squeezed together by gravity into neutrons, and so the amount of matter in it is very, very dense. When it gets even more dense, the matter ends up with the black hole that we've been discussing with. In other words, the collapse keeps on going and going, ongoing more or less to infinity down to a singularity. The point about that, of course, is that when the collapse actually occurs, with the matter falling in from the outside, hits a matter of such density that we just can't comprehend it, and it literally rebounds off it. And when it does so, it provides the energy to form the heavier elements all the way up to uranium that occur naturally. And this is then sprayed out into space so that second-generation stars then pick that matter up, not deliberately, of course, they just pick it up as they form. And so the sun is at least a second-generation star, and it's got a whole lot of stuff in it as well. And the disk from which the Earth and the other planets were formed contain these same minerals.
Stardust. So that means we are the residue of a star having exploded.
Correct. And that's because we do need in our design certain things like strange chemicals like cobalt, for example.
Right,
cobalt is a K-factor in an enzyme, and without it, the enzyme won't work, and we wouldn't exist. So all of these sort of things are there. But while the universe was expanding, it cooled. It's getting cooler and cooler and cooler. Now that means that the electromagnetic radiation that is not coming from a star that was originally present in the Big Bang expansion. Has had its wavelength expanded along with the universe. Its speed hasn't changed, it still moves at the speed of light, but the wavelength gets longer and longer, and we know that the energy of a photon of electromagnetic radiation is a thing called Planck's constant, which is designated as H, multiplied by its frequency, which of course is the inverse of the wavelength, multiplied by 2.
Of course.
So we all know that, and in other words, the longer the wavelength, the lower the frequency. The lower the frequency, the less amount of energy it has. This is what I was saying before, and you were saying, Larry, that it all dilutes. In other words, the energy is lost.
It has to dilute.
and because of that, what we find now is that this wavelength has come from gamma rays, which were very, very high energy electromagnetic radiation in the very early universe. And these have now been stretched out into microwaves that are very long. And the temperature of these microwaves is around about 2.73 degrees. So we can calculate the expansion of the universe simply by knowing the temperature of quark confinement and divided by the current temperature that we have now. And that gives you the expansion factor of, 9 by 10 to the 11, something like that. And then all we need to do then is to estimate the age of the universe, and that's where there's problems coming, because it was 14.7. Apparently now some people say that it's 13.7. I'm just looking at the internet now, and it says someone's universe is 13.82 billion years old, according to this site.
It is changing rapidly. It was estimated at 15 to 16 billion years, and then with the Wilkinson probe, it was taken to 13.4, and then the number was 13.7, and now it's 13.8. So there is no assurance. A lot of variables here.
Because of that uncertainty, my inclination would be to sort of deconstruct it by going backwards. In other words, you take the R statement at face value. It's true. Okay, we know with some high reasonable accuracy the expansion factor of the universe, roughly 10 to the 12. So now all we need to do is to sort of go backwards in the calculations to figure out how old the universe actually is. And it should be around about 14.7 billion years.
Yes.
Interesting.
And that falls really right within the realm of all of the math works at that number. It's right in the midst of the range.
I had done a note, Roy, and I just want to ask you this on amino acids. You know, all amino acids are left-handed, which really kind of blows the idea of, you know, random chance sort of out of the water in a lot of major ways.
Biological amino acids are, well, not quite true, but near enough. I think there's one or two strange organisms that do employ right chiral amino acids. But yes, you're right. Vast majority of them are, in fact, left chiral. What that means is that they rotate polarized light in one direction or the other. That's all.
No, I understand. I understand what it means is, you know, when you're looking at it, it seems to be turning left. Or I never knew that there were any organisms with right-handed amino acids.
They're very rare. You'd be hard pressed to find one. In fact, if you were to form amino acids in nature, as in fact that can happen. I think I've
mentioned
that
you're
before.
Staying within a line.
What you find is you get a racemic mixture. Sorry about these terms. That just simply means you've got the probability that you're going to have a left and a right. That's you might have heard of thalidomide.
Mm-hmm. Remember the babies? Said they killed all the babies or hurt all the babies?
It used to produce limbless babies and that sort of thing.
Yes.
It's no longer produced, of course, but the. That came in two chiral forms, and they weren't able to distinguish between the right and the left in those days, so they were simply marketed as one conglomerate. And when they took it, the babies got deformed because, I've forgotten which one was what. One of them is perfectly safe. The other one is the one that produces the deformation.
I'm assuming the one with the left hand would be safe and the one with the right hand would create the mutation or whatever.
Well, it might, but I don't know. The simple way of looking at it is if you put your hands out straight in front of you, turn the palms up, the thumb on the right turns to the right and the thumb on the left turns to the left.
Mm-hmm.
You can't put them in the same orientation, one on top of the other, without the thumb pointing in one direction and one of the thumb pointing in the other direction. So in other words, this is why, hence the name right and left-handed.
What do you think the purpose of a right-handed amino acid is, then? I mean, is there one that you can...
Well, I don't know of any. I don't know that there is a purpose. The fact that it might be the biochemistry, if it is, it's nothing that I've heard of. It doesn't mean to say that it isn't there, but it's just that biology, for some reason, has picked left-handed amino acids to work with. It may be that the chemistry becomes simpler. See, if you have a key in a lock and it's sort of about back to front, then that's a completely different arrangement. Now, an enzyme works by having what's called an active cleft. That means to say that there's a part of the... an enzyme is a protein, incidentally, as I'll explain to people who don't know. It's usually a protein. And biologically, it is a protein. And it's got other things that go with it, like, you know, what I mentioned before, like cobalt, for example, or whatever. And it has a part of the surface of the enzyme is either sticking out or is a cleft, such that when it meets the thing that it's going to react with and help cause the reaction, it fits that like a key in a lock. Mm-hmm. So what you may find is that if you have a right-handed system, that to manufacture the locks and the keys biologically may be much more difficult. In other words, you do require it to be left-handed for it to work efficiently. Because biology is all about the efficient use of energy. Otherwise, we're sort of always sort of just on the borderline of existence. We're always running hard against the laws of thermodynamics just to stay alive. The food that you eat and that sort of thing is just fuel that keeps thermodynamics at bay. We turn over the energy molecules in our body every few minutes. That's a thing called adenosine triphosphate or ATP.
That's why we cease to function without eating. It's for example, you can probably survive 40 days without eating anything. Just every aspect of your body degrades over that period of time, including your ability to think, if you don't keep it nourished. And with water, you go about 3 days, and that's it. We are right there at the ragged edge.
Well, there's another thing, that water is such a fascinating molecule. It's got all these wonderful characteristics. I mean, it supports life, we know, but it also has a triple point in the environment in which we exist. That is to say, you can have ice, water, and gas all in the three phases, all on Earth.
Right. Unlike anything else.
It also forms a nice blanket. The reason that we have any heat on the Earth at all that's compatible with life is because of water vapor in the atmosphere.
Right.
Water vapor in the atmosphere forms something like 95 to 98% of the heating effect. It's not carbon dioxide, despite the lies. In fact, the radiation...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's your global warming is water vapor.
Very
cold,
Dale.
Sure.
Yeah.
By the way, water is the only substance that I'm aware of that actually expands when it's cooled.
Yes, that's right.
And if it wasn't
otherwise,
for that... life could not exist on this planet.
Not only... Well, imagine your pond. Here's your pond with your fish and your algae and all these other things in it.
Right.
And the water on the top freezes.
Right. Right.
But it acts as an insulator and it prevents the... And because it's floating, because it's less dense, then it prevents the water underneath from freezing.
Correct.
So your life...
And if
life
that had not
continue.
Happened since life all came out of the oceans... If the inverse of that had happened, life could not, would never have existed on this planet.
Yes.
And it, it wouldn't even last through the first winter, even now.
Mm. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so many things that all tie in together. You know, you are saying about separating the waters from the land.
Yes. Yeah, where it's the act of the second creative day. And in fact, even stars are born in stellar nurseries, if you will, and they're filled with water vapor, with water. You know, not in a liquid form, but hydrogen and oxygen bound together.
Yeah, but of course, the any water that is in our star, for example, or any star for that matter, can't be in the form of even water vapor. The temperature is way too high for that. It dissociates into hydrogen and oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And the hydrogen can then be used as a fuel, nuclear fuel. As
right.
can the oxygen too later on, but not straight away.
Right.
So, yes, the whole thing is just so tied together beautifully.
Yeah. The world's most sophisticated equation.
For those who don't know about anything about biology, there's an excellent book by a fellow, it is a pseudonym, I think, Mike Gene, G-E-N-E, and it's called The Design Matrix. And he actually, his basic hypothesis in that is that, in fact, evolution, that is to say, microevolution or evolution distinct from abiogenesis, which means spontaneous generation of life, was front-loaded into the DNA. And he actually goes through and shows you how that's done. He's obviously a very well-researched... He's obviously a molecular biologist. He obviously knows what he's talking about. It's a book worth reading. It's projected for the layman. It's not... It does involve a few sections that are a bit deep, but not too much. So, I mean, everyone, if you want to read it, can go through and have a look at that. It's well worth a read. So when you come up against your agnostic or atheist talking about evolution, then you can point that out to them. That usually stops them in their tracks.
What's the name of that book?
Basically, evolution is front-loaded.
Right.
And it's front-loaded by Yah. In other words, Yah has designed in... The reason that he... When you think... Again, it's a logical thing. He must have designed it in there, if you want to sort of reverse engineer that. He must have done that because, you see, if he's a hands-off creator, he's got to make a system that's going to be able to not only...
Adapt.
Start off, but it's got to be able to continue down through the ages through all these indeterminate factors that are going to occur in his universe, because the universe is not determinate.
Yes.
He's got to enable the system to continue to run in one form or another. So we get some extinctions and some other things that occur because of changes in the DNA. So the DNA itself is engineered in such a way that the that life will spontaneously, if you like, change.
Yeah, that's the reason why an organism can evolve what appears to become more sophisticated is only because the DNA was programmed with that capability.
Correct, yes. In fact, he demonstrates that right at the end of the book. He shows his hand and... He says, okay, we've got an organism that is a single cell. It never is anything but a single cell. But it's got in there enzymes that are necessary for multicellular life. There's no reason for the enzymes to be there. Even if they were there by an accident, they would have washed out in the evolutionary process. And by that I mean, because life has to use energy very efficiently. If you're producing something that you don't need, it's just unnecessary baggage. It's like carrying lead in the saddlebags.
Right.
You throw it out after a while. So
you're saying that a single-cell organism has within its DNA the functionality to govern multi-cells.
Correct.
And that there's no way to explain that via either natural selection or any form of evolution. There would be no reason for the DNA of a single cell organism to have the ability to create, manage, and replicate multi-cells.
Exactly. I mean, it's completely against evolutionary theory.
Correct.
That by itself...
That's a great point.
Yeah, that itself would destroy the current versions of evolution. But the really dangerous part, of course, is abiogenesis. And I was watching a program with a smarmy physicist from the UK. I've forgotten his name now. He's a professor of physics. And he's talking about how these, you know, say for example, amino acids and that sort of thing occur spontaneously, which is Miller's experiment back in the 50s. And they do. You can cook up an atmosphere and put sparks through it, and lo and behold, out pop these amino acids. But that's
right. Yeah, I've actually read that some years ago.
Life is not just simply the. It's again coming back to the marks on a page. It's the code that is life. It's the DNA code. You can make any number of DNA molecules. Well, you can't actually, but I mean you can make the backbones, for example, of DNA. And you can even spontaneously make the rungs of the ladder for DNA. But unless they're actually in the right order and in the functional order,
you can't put them together. You've got something worthless. And it doesn't live long either, that too.
Well, how's it going to reproduce? Think of the reproductive machinery needed. How's it going to reproduce? None of that would exist in those days. How's it going to feed itself? Does it need feeding? You know? How long will it last?
Where is the food? Where is the organic material for it to feed itself?
Exactly. I mean,
so where
the whole
is
thing
it?
Is
right. How does it find it? How does
absurd.
It process it? And then how does it replicate it itself? Oh, they are
it's like saying there's an Empire State Building over there, and you learned how to make a brick. I mean, that's what it is. That's exactly
what
it is.
Yeah, it's saying that somebody that was capable of making a mud brick, given enough time, could build the Empire State Building, complete with the HVAC systems, elevators, electrical systems, and lighting and all of that. Technically, it is mathematically possible, given enough time. The extrapolation to those things is just for life to have been conceived from inorganic material pushes mathematical credulity to a point of almost a farce. But then you get to, okay, then where's its food? How does it find its food? How does it turn that food into something that is useful? How does it reproduce? How does it manage it? Its systems. And
All of these sophisticated cellular machinery to do it. We know that.
Boy, let me just ask you a quick question while we're in it. How does the chaos theory fit into all of this?
Chaos
tools where everything is calm and that's where things life can generate.
It's just random chance. That's all.
Yeah.
That's essentially all chaos is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not strictly true. I mean, chaos is a little chaos theory is still in its infancy. We know, for example, that if you I'll give you an example. If you turn on a tap and just allow a little thin filament of water fall out of it, you see that it accelerates under gravity. It's going faster and faster as it gets further away from the tap. So it's adopted, and because of the stickiness of the water molecules have got a slight charge, polar charge on them, they take a shape. It's sort of like a funnel and it gets thinner and thinner. And all of a sudden, at some point, it breaks up into drops. Now, that's a version of chaos. We can mathematically describe what happens while it's in the streamlined flow, but the moment that it breaks up into drops, it becomes completely indeterminate. We cannot tell what happens.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that, but the curious thing is that in some physical situations, you may actually find that order appears spontaneously out of chaos. Now, I don't know if anyone's ever figured out why that happens. It just does. You can see a roiling river, for example, going over rapids, but you can have an area, even in the middle of the roiling water, there's a little area of relative calm. It just sort of might be just turning slowly as a sort of an eddy, but it's still a well-defined structure within that unstructured mess that's around it. And it's not just confined, of course, to Earth. If you have a look at Jupiter, The great red spot is, in fact, an exact analog of what I just said then. It's a huge structured cyclone or hurricane in the midst of chaos. And you can actually see in the time-lapse photographs the chaotic material falling into it, becoming relatively stable and structured, and then falling out of it again. So, yes, chaos is indeterminate, but with a bit of order sort of built into it as well, somehow.
If chaos did not exist, then there would be really no purpose in this whole grand experiment that you engaged in. Chaos is the only thing that makes it potentially interesting. You know, if everything was programmed...
Well, then you'd know everything if you didn't have that.
It would know every outcome. Every outcome is essentially predetermined. It's written into the original formula.
Yeah.
And so you really have to have chaos to have choice, to make things interesting.
That's true. But you can see it everywhere. You can see it in the stock market. You can see it in the weather. You can see it even in human dynamics. Wars, for example. We're living at the moment, at the end of a relatively stable period. Soon there'll be some wars, and that's instability in a great way. You can't predict what's going to happen. You can tell, for example, that the Fed is going to print money tomorrow and that the gold cartel is going to criminally suppress the price of gold tomorrow. But when the war comes, you don't know what's going to happen. Anything could happen. I mean, the U.S. could be obliterated from the map by a few nuclear bombs.
Correct.
Or EMPs or whatever the day after. Who knows? War is a totally indeterminate thing.
Right. And it has to be that way. If it were not that way, there couldn't be free will. And Yahweh would know the outcome of everything from the original equation that he conceived to begin all of this process. The end would be known at the time of the beginning.
At all. Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so,
you know, I mean, he talks about hydrogen. He talks about also water. I mean, that, I guess, brings up, the Goldilocks zone, right? I mean, you know, where does that fit in? I mean, it's obviously, you know, these things are written about in Bereshit. I mean, we know now that you have to have water to have a planet, right? I mean,
you can have a planet without water, but you can't have life, as we know it. But you know that they search for water because where they have liquid water, there is the potential for life. There are so many other aspects to Earth other than just liquid water. It's this Goldilocks zone. Like, for example, if our moon wasn't at its present size and its present distance from the Earth, and there were not the tidal effect...
The oceans would become a sewer, as an example.
Right.
Sure. I mean, that would be
so that's just a little thing. But the fact that the Earth is rotation, it is at an angle to the sun, is hugely important. Virtually, there's just so many aspects of our, you know, our distance from the sun, the size of our sun. There are so many variables.
So they bring up the Goldilocks zone and hope that there's some accidental form of life somewhere.
There's far more to it than just the size of the star and the distance from that star, and the density and size of that particular planet. Those are the variables they look at for the Goldilocks zone.
Possibility.
The distance from the star and the intensity of that star. There are lots more things going on than.
No, I agree. With that. Yeah, sure.
Than just those. Than just, that isn't enough. Temperature.
Well, I'm with you. I mean, the E equals MC squared puts you out of the possibility in this physical realm.
Well, yeah,
realm.
We look at... Yeah,
we're never getting
example,
anywhere
to
where there
right
would
that
be life.
The overwhelming
system.
Percentage of the warmth that we experience here on Earth is a function of the water vapor in the air. So if,
that's right.
If you didn't have water, even if you were
the
in the
greenhouse
zone, right, you'd be freezing cold. be no way to convey that warmth in a way that would be meaningful. You know, if the Earth's Teutonic plates weren't as they are, wouldn't be any life on this planet. Even the Teutonic plates are necessary for life.
Really? I didn't realize that. Of course, I've been looking at that.
What plates did you say?
The Teutonic plates, the movement of the Earth's crust.
Well, the tectonic plates.
Tectonic plates, I'm sorry. Tectonic, yeah.
Yeah, clean it up a little bit over there.
I will. Yeah, really.
Making us look bad.
Hey,
Roy, what was the name of that book,
English.
By the way? What was the name of that book?
It's called The Design Matrix.
Design Matrix, okay.
The Design Matrix, and it's by a fellow whose pseudonym is Mike Gene, G-E-N-E.
Okay. Well, see, guys, I want to give Roy a run for his money here in a couple months. You watch.
You got a lot of reading.
Oh, no way. It's taken me
You're right
years
about
to get
that.
To where I am.
I got so many holes in my head from, you know, just trying to make a business work every day. It's not ever likely to happen.
I wish I had a business because my capital's running down fast now that I've retired. I might be forced back into work.
Oh, no.
I hope that doesn't happen.
And the last time you worked before you retired, you were a physician?
That's right, yes.
And
what line were you in there?
General practice.
GP?
I did radiology for 4 years, but as Craig now knows, there's a lot of you-know-what licking going on. Well, where doesn't it? A lot of politics, a lot of licking going on. I went to the wrong hospital, even though I was catheterizing people's arteries and running the catheters internally up to the arch of the aorta and looking at the blood vessels in the head and reading the x-rays and doing that sort of thing. The examinations are in two parts. They're run by the college, they're marked by the college, and you're determined whether or not you pass. I was there with a friend who had at one stage in the past every examination that they'd ever set, but they would not permit him into the college. I was given a fail in the first part of the examination, even though I got 4 passes. So I said, okay, this is obviously a corrupt, that's right, this is you can't appeal it.
Wow.
You see, that's the principal professional body. You've got to go to the right places and meet the right people and lick the, you know, appropriate parts thereof appropriately, and you will be allowed to get through.
Yeah, there's a whole lot going on in the hospitals over here. Yalda's got a friend, she went to Yale, and she's, I think she's a radiologist, actually, and her name's Mona, and she was looking at a chart of a guy that was being treated for cancer, or getting ready to, and she said, well, this you don't have cancer. She was, you know, looking, and her superior came in and said, well, you know, I just put that there to see if you would find it, and she said, he's not my patient. So that means they're running around treating people for cancer just for the purposes of gaining money, and that's what she pretty much told us. I believe her.
There's an even more significant thing is a certain member of the family, I don't know whether on this show I should name her, so I won't. She had a lesion in the left lower lobe of the lung, and someone had taken an x-ray, and there was a very obvious lesion on the PA. When you take a chest x-ray, you do a front to back, and you do a lateral. For some reason, the lateral didn't seem... Well, I wasn't showing a lateral, I'll put it that way. But on the PA, you could clearly see this lesion that was there. It wasn't an eventration of the diaphragm. It wasn't a fat pad or anything like that. It was just a straight-out circular lesion that was visible on the just near the cardiac border. And no one commented on it. No one did anything about it. I find this absolutely amazing. Right?
Well, I'm sure it probably works both ways. You know, maybe they didn't have the insurance to handle it. I just don't know.
Yeah. Well,
oh, good grief.
I think it's You know, if you, I read an article here about 6 months ago on the leading cause of death in America. And the leading cause of death in America is no longer cardiac disease. It used to be cardiac disease followed by auto accidents. And then and then cancer was third. Those were the big three. So pulmonary disease was number one, auto accidents was number two, and cancer was number three. You know what the leading cause of death now is in America?
Medical error.
Medical error. You're correct. Medical error.
Huge.
That's just astounding. That the place that, you know, is supposed to be able to cure you and to be a benefit to your health is the single greatest cause of death now in the country, medical error.
Yeah. But, Craig, that's somehow what you'd expect, isn't it? If the country's corrupt, everything in it's going to be corrupt. See, when I went through medical school, we had to study hard and to know. We were expected to know everything when we came out. We were deemed to know everything, obviously with a few exceptions, the things called the specialties. You were expected to be able to deliver babies. You were expected to be able to set practically or most fractures and that sort of thing. There are a few things that required hospitalization and it was certainly beyond your abilities, but you were expected to do a lot. Nowadays, I was involved for a while in training medical students, and my God, it was just appalling. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. It's part of my never mind.
Yeah.
We won't go there. The students come out as undifferentiated doctors, whatever that hell means. You know, they know nothing. And then during the anatomy courses that I was training them, they knew nothing about anatomy. And there's one thing I can tell a little story, if I may, if you've got time.
Sure. Before you tell your story, here's my theory on what you're observing, is that to succeed in medical school, they had to know stuff, but they ceased understanding things. And so they could pare it back to stuff they knew, even though they didn't understand any of it. And it's the same thing that's happened in political correct education. It's become indoctrination where the student passes through the grades by parroting back what they have been told, but are no longer able to think and therefore understand any of it.
Mm. Like Babel, huh?
Babel, indeed. Yes,
so what are your stories? Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, there was a gynecological case that they were going through. They're supposed to sort of figure out, they dig down in depth and figure out all of the aspects of the case that we're dealing with. And I said I think it came up, I can't remember how it came up, but I said to the class, okay, so now what about your embryology? Do you now understand the embryology of the female genitalia? And there was silence, and I said, okay, well, there's a structure called the hymen. Where is the hymen? Silence. I looked at him and said, what on earth is going on here?
In a medical school? Really?
In a medical school. I said, where is the hymen? And there was boys and girls in there. And I said, okay, you don't know. Well, get an anatomy text and look it up. And do you know who was the person who went to the anatomy thing? Was a girl.
She didn't know where the hymen was.
She didn't. I mean, any red-blooded male knows exactly where the hymen is over on this side of the world.
It's a thing that
well, maybe on your side.
And every woman that's not hideously ugly by the third grade in America.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you find a virgin America? It's an ugly girl in the third grade.
She's not a Muslim.
And she'd have to be non-Muslim.
Mutilated by
right.
her parents.
Yeah. No, but the thing about that, the significance of that is that the way the body develops, of course, is sort of an outer layer, if you like, called the soma, and there's an inner layer called the viscera. And the visceral part grows towards the somatic part, and where they join, that's where the hymen is. So that's what that was all about. But I was absolutely astounded that none of them knew. You think something as so basic as that. And these people were not just beginning. They were about, they were postgraduates in various degrees, but 1 or 2 years into the medical course. So I put in a formal complaint, and you know what happened?
Oh, of course you
I was got rid of.
You're the guy that got the trouble, right?
I was the guy that got in the trouble, yep. Because I was rocking
about... My son teaches organic chemistry at a university, and he will tell me that the students he really does not like are the pre-med students that take his classes, because there's this entitlement for a grade regardless of performance, and there's absolutely no desire to understand. And so he'll he tutors a bunch of students, and those who simply say, listen, I'm trying to get an A so I can move on and go to medical school. I don't want to understand why this works. Just tell me the answer. I'll memorize the answer. I said, there's almost no desire to understand the process. I mean, the whole thing...
I certainly wouldn't want that doctor working on me. I wouldn't want that doctor working on me. I want somebody that has an understanding of what's going on rather than somebody that's just parroting back whatever's been memorized. No, I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you. I mean, that's probably a lost art. It probably is.
Even memorizing, I mean, if you know your anatomy, you can at least be a surgeon.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, as
what if you don't
you
know anatomy, you're trying to be a surgeon.
Right.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So you can be a surgeon by memorizing the parts of the anatomy and what they're supposed to look like. Yeah, what to do and what not to do on these circumstances without understanding any of the functionality. But the problem is that any time there is an issue, when things go awry, when something is out of the ordinary, which is the whole nature of chaos theory, if you don't understand the process, you're dead in the water. It's why when I started doing radio as opposed to just writing, that I was reluctant to do so, because I realized there's lots of people that know more than I know. And I finally developed a comfort level with it, because I realized there's very few people that understand. And if somebody really does understand, what I'm saying is going to resonate with them. They're not going to be an opponent to it. And if you understand, nobody can actually debate you effectively based on knowledge alone.
Well, it's like listening to these political actors today, okay? Yeah, I mean, you'll hear the stupidest things. The things that will actually be discussed are almost minutia. You know, if they ever got into what's really wrong, they wouldn't be there, correct? I mean, if you're aware of what's happening around you, you realize that everything they're saying is basically meaningless. I mean, it really is. I have not seen any of them really, really go after the problem. Not at all.
Correct. No, if you understood the problem, you wouldn't be part of it. You wouldn't even attempt to be part of the solution.
Well, no, you couldn't be, could you?
You wouldn't come to the conclusion that Roy came to, which is that while we cannot say for certain what series of events are going to ultimately destroy America, its days are numbered.
Yeah, no, it's going to be destroyed.
There are less than 20 years left. Right. And so if you understood what has destroyed America, you would not be part of trying to solve these things, because they can't be solved.
You can't go out and look for a savior in America. I mean, that's just stupid.
You can't make some great.
It'd be very much like having a bucket and saying that with a bucket I could keep the Titanic from sinking.
No. It's very much like that. You're right.
And so if you actually understood where we are monetarily, where we are in terms of militarily, where we are in terms of our Justice Department and our policing, where we are with Islam, where we are religiously and politically, if you understood where we are and educationally with political correctness, if you understood where we were in these various ailments, you'd recognize that you were simply a person with holding one bucket, and there's 100 holes. and a ship of state.
As far as understanding goes, though, Craig, I have to tell you that the way I think, or the way my mind seems to work now, is that I use your translations to gain an overall picture in my mind of what's going on. In other words, I don't sort of delve into the minutiae of the particular meanings of Niffel and Hiffel and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What I do is when I first, oh, I mean, I do look into them. I'm not saying that I ignore it completely, but what I get is an overall sense of what is intended,
mm-hmm.
so that you then gain understanding of what's necessary. And when you do that, mm-hmm. then you can find that having gained that, you can then build on it, so that the next
right.
time you come across a similar situation, you can then, from your
basic
understanding, know what he's talking about and what you expect to find in the translation.
Now, this may surprise you, but I do the same thing.
So do I.
I do exactly the same thing. Just because I create the translation does not mean that I don't create the translation for the translation's sake. I only create the translation because I want to extrapolate from it.
Yeah, for the purposes of understanding.
And
that's what led us to this conversation tonight.
I'll look at the Hiffel, and I'll look at the call, and I'll look at the conjugation, and I'll look at the mood, and I'll define the word, but I'm only doing it for one purpose.
What about coordinatives?
Absolutely. Don't leave them out.
Okay, I just wanted to get that out there.
Or the paragogic. You know.
Why don't we talk about chemistry some more with Roy? I couldn't do it.
That's the reason why I can't just do a translation is because the translation is just part of the process. And the translation, what it enables is what you're doing with them. Now,
hey, Roy, can I ask you something? Did English class ever put you to sleep like it did me? I mean, I can give a great speech. I really can. I've done it many times. English class, I mean, when you started talking about participles and this and that, dangling participle. Yeah, I mean, my head hits the table by then. I mean, I'm just like, what am I doing here? You know,
I actually have to revise all that stuff now to understand what it is. I don't really remember very much what I think about it. Sorry?
I mean, I could just through this stuff, but I mean, it just put me to sleep. It was awful.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just awful. You know, to even have to, you know.
Joe, real quickly, I'm going to cut out because I got to rope the door before it gets dark here, but
we'll
exit tonight.
Well, I'm going to see you in 10 minutes, aren't I, Kurt?
Okay, buddy. Shabbat shalom. Thank you for letting me be here.
Yep.
And I'll see you later, okay?
Thanks, Kurt.
The Talk Radio cut us off hard, so that might as well say goodbye now because it's going to shut us all down here in just a matter of seconds.
In 7 minutes.
Well, probably cost a fortune with this phone call anyway.
Roy, it was a pleasure.
Thank you for doing it, Roy. We love you, buddy.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
We enjoy you. We love you. We've all grown because of you. So we're family. And we appreciate you a great deal.
And you. Bye.
Well, thank you. Bye, guys. Good night.
Bye.